Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody. This is Victoria Lupashku, and this is East Asian Studies Channel from New Books Network. Today, we're here with Dr. Mayfair Young, and I want to welcome her to our channel and to thank her for agreeing to talk to us about her new book, Reenchanting Modernity, Ritual Economy and Society in Wenzhou, China, published by Duke University Press in 2020. Welcome, Dr. Young.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So we'll start the interview by asking you more about how you came to this project. You know, what got you interested in and maintained your interest in China as an academic subject in the first place, since you have been having a really amazing career and have been publishing prolifically since the 1990s?
So I'm an Asian American, born in Taiwan, first generation immigrant to the U.S., and I've been fascinated by mainland China since I was an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley a long time ago. So I also wanted to understand my parents' heritage. So back then, when I got really interested in China as an undergraduate, China was still pretty much a communist closed society, which made it all the more mysterious and alluring. So at that time, I double majored in Chinese language, and at that time, it was actually called Oriental Languages Department. Yep. And I also majored in cultural anthropology. While in the East Asian department, I was not interested in the attitude that all the greatness of China was in the past. I was very much fascinated by what could be going on in China today. So I wanted, and yet there was very little literature on exactly what China was like. We got a lot of propaganda literature coming out of China, but not very many people going there. So I became really curious at that time.
That is really fascinating. And I have to say, and I apologize to the listeners, but if I said this in any other occasions, but my own undergraduate education is in Oriental languages, because the Oriental languages department still exists in many places in Eastern Europe. So I think we can, you know, talk about different legacies, right, that have maintained. You know, that aside, just as a personal anecdote a little bit, you know, I noticed that you start the book by saying that you did not set out to study religious cultures, but you were confronted with their salience in the field. So could you please tell us more about this fact that you encountered?
Yeah, you know, my first book was about gift giving and personal connections. And in the process of doing that research, I came to understand, you know, doing fieldwork and living in Beijing for 2 years, over 2 years for that, I came to understand that during the Maoist era, China had become a highly centralized and bureaucratic state-dominated society. And I kept on bumping into nails, trying to get permission to do fieldwork in a factory in Beijing. And when you have to deal with the bureaucracy, they always say no. So So basically, you know, I thought, and then I came to really appreciate this notion of civil society. And it's very interesting, of course, civil society comes out of the West European Enlightenment era, and all those major philosophers. Discourse was very big in the Enlightenment. You know, they were witnessing the absolutist state in Europe at that time. And then it went into a lull, and nobody in the West was really interested in civil society. But what brought about the revival were Eastern European intellectuals in the 1970s and 80s who started talking about civil society again. So in that context, and given my having lived in China, I really appreciated this new notion of civil society. So I wanted to go to a very rural part of China in search of the sprouts of civil society in peasant culture, because up until the 90s, my work had been in Beijing in an urban part. So I was introduced by a Chinese friend to Wenzhou. And this area really reminded me of my childhood in Taiwan, where it was very bustling. It's a rapidly developing rural to urban transition. People are very busy and moving around via pedicabs and motorcycles, which was the case in Wenzhou in the 90s. So at first, I explored secular non-governmental organizations in my project to look for civil society in Wenzhou. And I interviewed a private school, entrepreneurs association. I interviewed people at the local writers federation, a stamp collecting society, and so forth. But I found that in terms of how they were established, their funding source, their organizational ethos, and their activities, they all seemed very state-oriented and beholden. So they often adopted some sort of state language. And I discovered that the more independent associations, such as the deity temples, Taoist and Buddhist temples, and lineage ancestor halls, and even Christian churches, all these that were truly initiated and funded by grassroots forces, these all had a ritual and religious dimension. And so I realized while doing fieldwork that I had to focus on these. Despite the fact that local authorities discouraged my efforts, and I had to retool my intellectual approach because I hadn't really received training in the study of religion. So I had to read up on the anthropology of religion. So I was very impressed with how the local people were so patient and persistent and so highly motivated and very impressively organized in their struggles with officialdom to retrieve and restore old temple sites and petition for permits to use land and build new ritual sites. And so basically, I found that religion and ritual were very salient in the field. And even though I had not planned to deal with religion, I had to confront it.
Absolutely. And it seems that, it's one of the very, very interesting ways in which the field and what you find in the field almost pushes you to retool, to, you know, try to get access and to understand what is happening there. And I think we definitely see this in the book itself, which is comprised of 10 chapters divided into three parts, and of course with the addition of the conclusion chapter. And in the introduction part, you lay out the importance of rituals and the existence, as well as the long history of a ritual economy in Wenzhou, which is in Zhejiang province, China. And I was wondering whether you could tell our listeners more about how these key phrases, so rituals, ritual economy and so on, how do they function in your work and how they structure the book itself?
Okay, because I'm going to discuss ritual economy later, so I will put the focus on two keywords here. One, the book title is Reenchanting Modernity. And so it invokes Max Weber, the famous sociologist, who also, wrote a few books on Chinese religions. He regretted how modernity was a process of disenchantment, in his words, and which was about secularization that ushered in the age of utilitarianism, cold-blooded bureaucratism, and rationalization, which is another one of his terms. And these processes often tended to suspend the consideration of ethics. So, when I look at China, under pressure and threat from the imperialist West that had made it into a semi-colony, 20th century China, in this sort of crisis trauma period, embraced the modern Western notion that one had to destroy one's traditional culture and religions in order to modernize and catch up with the West. So China also, of course, with the Communist Revolution, armed itself with the linear evolutionary teleology of a crude sort of Marxism, which propelled it to turn against its own so-called backward feudal superstitions in order to join the industrialized world. So China wanted to modernize and industrialize without capitalism. So it expanded its ancient centralized state into a much more penetrating and all-controlling state than ever before, never before in its history. So it's against this historical background of severe state secularization that I'm examining the significance of this reenchantment going on in Wenzhou today with the religious revival. And the other term that I'd like to address that I use in chapter one in my introduction is post-secularism, which is a term made more popular by Jürgen Habermas. So post-secularism, it's kind of like the term postmodern in that it's a critique of the excesses of secularism, just as postmodern is a critique of the excesses of the notion of modernization, modernity. So in China, secularism has had a kind of demonization of religion at times. So just like modernity, now that we have seen all the new problems that secularism entails, we have entered into a post period where we start to question our past infatuation with secularism or modernity, and we re-examine religiosity from a new angle. So in some circles, there is a kind of thinking that much as modernist discourses would like to, we can not get rid of religiosity. It's a deeply entrenched thing that if you try to kill it and shove it away, it will come back in new, unexpected forms. So definitely one fruitful avenue of exploring the fact that you cannot get rid of religion is in thinking about nationalism. Nationalism, it can be seen in some ways as a new kind of a new way that religiosity has retreated to. Okay, and I think many of us are aware of some of the excesses and destructiveness of ultranationalism of all different kinds. So for me, in this reexamination of secularization and religiosity, there's a historical irony in the fact that China so embraced the Western opposition between religion and science and between religion and economy. So first of all, we need to consider that this Western opposition between religion and science and between religion and economy, which has been globalized, this opposition, doesn't do justice to the particularity of religion in China. Because, of course, the Western opposition is based on opposing Christianity against science and Christianity against economy. But other places, this opposition really doesn't work very well. Because unlike Christianity, Chinese religions, popular religion, Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and so forth, were plural traditions. They coexisted, and they were not posited as a singular truth because there were many religious traditions, and they were often blended in syncretic ways in China, in the history of China. Indeed, both in the past in China and also today, we see that many of these religious traditions are not opposed to science, but can be compatible. Especially Taoism and Buddhism and Confucianism. Furthermore, China underwent a commercial revolution about 1,000 years ago during the Song Dynasty in the 11th century, at a time when Europe was still in the Dark Ages. In the Song Dynasty, religion was no obstacle to economic development, which during that time, there was a real commercial flowering. But religion at that time was a crucial element and a driving force, as it is today, I believe, in Wenzhou. So those are the two terms I wanted to elaborate on. And then I'll talk about ritual economy.
Absolutely, sure. And, I definitely have questions that that point to that later on. I think furthermore, I would just want to ask a little bit more about the introduction, although you already touched on some of the point that I want to make. And I'm sorry if it's a bit repetitive. And, you know, please feel free to ask me to move further if that's the case. But I was very interested in this quote where you say that Wenzhou religiosity was an active engagement with modernity, a willed reenchantment, as well as that the revival of local religious identities can moderate the intense emotional attachments to the centralizing nation state. End of quote. So the notions of modernity, nation state, and local religious identities were key in my perspective here, and you already touched on the relationship between nation state, nationalism, modernity, and religion. But here, the term local and local religious identities seem to be key, and specifically in the climate in Wenzhou. So I don't know if there was anything that you wanted to add here to further expand on.
Yeah, sure. I talk about reenchantment as not just a blind continuity with the past, but as a willed reenchantment, because these people living in Wenzhou that I studied and talked with, they all went through a very severe state secularization during the Maoist era, and also before that during the Republican era of the government of Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek. And so from the beginning of the 20th century, you had this impulse towards condemning traditional religiosity. So these people have gone through all that. During the Maoist period, there was virtually no public religious activities allowed, and they were taught about the evils of superstition. But in the relaxation, political relaxation during the post-Mao period, they still wanted to go back to these religious activities. And it suggests that they see something that the dominant discourse fails to recognize. Okay. So I see their re-enchantment activities as efforts by the local people to rebalance the state distortion of Chinese modernity, to reintroduce religious ethics, to rebuild the lost horizontal community ties that had been replaced with by top-down vertical bureaucratic commands. I see it as an effort to strengthen local autonomy, self-governance, and social initiatives at the grassroots, from the grassroots for the public good. And the way that I see their re-enchantment as strengthening local self-governance and building a religious civil society is that, like Catholic saints, most Chinese gods were once virtuous human beings who sacrificed for or benefited others, or who had an invention of something innovative that benefited future generations. So these Chinese gods have hagiographies in written records, and they're usually treated as territorial gods who may or may not have been born in the local area. But whose worship builds up local identity, community solidarity, and local memory. So in the context of modern Chinese history, where you have a totalizing nationalism and a centralized state, where these forces have become overwhelming, I'm suggesting that re-enchantment in Wenzhou helps to redress the imbalance of the 20th century by strengthening local self-governance and community bonds in the context of the overwhelming nation-state buildup. So in contrast to nation-state, this kind of religiosity emphasizes localities, which can also easily become transnational localities because they cross national boundaries. Wenzhou people are very entrepreneurial. They fan across not only China, but also into Asia and even into Africa. And they also reach upward beyond the nation state to the afterlife and the realm of the gods, immortals, and Buddhas above. So I'm seeing them as building up local identity, and which can be transnational, and they're also going beyond the nation state to basically transcendent authorities, beyond temporal authorities.
And just to testify to what you said, for my time that I spent in Pennsylvania, one of the local restaurants was actually owned by someone from Wenzhou, and they were saying they have a local, a little temple in their house, and, you know, they have gatherings and, you know, perform these probably altered type of rituals. Probably they're a little different than what they would be in China. But, you know, just to testify to what you're saying, that it really goes beyond Wenzhou as it is in China. Right.
Yeah. And some Chinese restaurants and even Vietnamese restaurants and so forth, they have little altars in the restaurant, right, to the earth god or to the god of wealth. And they turned their restaurants into a little temple.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, as you're mentioning all of these things, I really cannot stop but think about methodology. This is so fertile ground to research. And you know, I was wondering about your preferred methods of approaching the topic and just managing the trips to China every year. How did that look for you?
Okay. Yeah. I'm trained as a cultural anthropologist, a PhD in anthropology at UC Berkeley. So the preferred methodology is long-term immersive field work where you're living with the people for, you know, about a year and sharing their daily lives. However, I was not able to do this because I could never get long-term visas. And so my longest stay was over 2 months. And I also had teaching and administrative duties back at UC Santa Barbara.
Sure.
So this is why the book perhaps took so long. I kept feeling I had to go back for more field work to make sure I got everything right, especially since the local language is so difficult to understand. And I often had to find Mandarin speakers. Part of the reason why this area... I'm working in rural and small town areas. The reason why this area has is so strong in religion, traditional religion and ritual, various reinventions of them, is that the educational level is low. This area was very poor during the Maoist era because their entrepreneurial culture just wasn't acceptable in the Maoist era of rural collectivization. So the people who could speak Mandarin were men who had joined the army and learned Mandarin traveling around China. Most of the women above 30 could not speak any Mandarin. So it was a struggle, but you know, over the years, of course, the place became better educated. I made 13 trips over a 26-year period, which is a very long time. Each trip was anywhere from 2 weeks to over 2 months, and totaling 42 weeks, which is respectable. Spread over such a long period, I was really able to see the historical changes and unfolding of all these religious sites. I would live in people's homes or in small local hotels and also in a couple of Buddhist monasteries in the women's dormitory part. And I would generally rely on friends and contacts to introduce me to people to interview. Or I would also wander around to ritual sites and seek out people who were willing to talk with me. It's a kind of snowball effect of relying on people I already knew or contacts I initiated to introduce me to more people.
And this hard work and the different perspectives really stand out from the amount of details that the book contains. And it does appear to me that part one, not only chapter one, but chapter two and three too, but you know, the whole book, of course, does a lot of this heavy lifting in familiarizing the reader with Wenzhou and the religious and ritual economy there. So I was wondering whether you could tell us a bit more about the work that part one does for the readers.
Okay, yeah. So we've talked a fair amount about chapter one, which is the introduction, yeah. And it lays out the sort of the theoretical issues that I want to discuss about secularization and modernity and the rejection of religion in modern China. So I'll focus here more on chapter two, which is a discussion of the Wenzhou model. And this is a Chinese term, Wenzhou 模式, which describes the Wenzhou model of rural economic development. And this model is based on a small private family-owned factories and businesses. And this area is known for its entrepreneurial culture, its rapid rural economic development, industrialization, and commerce. And Wenzhou people are generally seen as prosperous, highly geographically mobile, and even transnationally mobile. However, the term Wenzhou model it doesn't, for me, describe sufficiently what should be entailed in the Wenzhou model, because generally it leaves out the religious and ritual components, which I have discovered is quite central to economic development here. So I set up the discussion that Wenzhou model is too limited because it doesn't include religious activities, which motivate and channel economic behavior. Indeed, I see a second Song Dynasty commercial revolution in Wenzhou all over again, where religiosity is central.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a resurgence. And Wenzhou seems to have played a very important role in history, you know, in the long history of China. So I absolutely agree with that. And I think in part two, right, entitled Religious Diversity and Syncretism, and containing chapters 3, 4, and 5, you do put forth a rich ethnographic and historical account of different forms of religious and ritual life in contemporary Wenzhou. And as you mentioned, you know, popular religion, Taoism and Buddhism. And this is all a quote from the book. So, you know, my question would be, what are these accounts, right, in more detail?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, chapter three is on popular religion. And so I describe the components of what I consider popular religion. So it includes deity worship, and there are so many deities, so many that I encountered for the first time. And some of these deities are shared. They are gods and goddesses. They're shared between Wenzhou and other parts of China, especially with Fujian and also with Taiwan. Another part of popular religion are things like divination and fortune telling, feng shui or Chinese geomancy for citing important spaces like ancestral tombs and also homes that people live in, and even shops and factories. People want to consult a geomantic master to tell them which direction it should face and which spot is the best. It also includes shamanism, spirit mediumship, and ritual healing. It also includes death rituals and placating of ghosts. Here I also discuss the terminology for how to translate the notion of popular religion into modern Chinese. And I even propose a Chinese term that integrates the late imperial term of local customs, fengshu, with the term for folk, minjian, with the modern term for religion, zongjiao. And I come up with minsu zongjiao as my proposal for how to translate the category of popular religion into modern Chinese. Then chapter four is a chapter on Taoism. And I talk about how in the West, Taoism really appeals to a kind of post-Reformation kind of centering on the self and on self-cultivation. So in the modern West, Taoism is understood mainly in terms of self-cultivation. But in Wenzhou and in other parts of China, but especially in Wenzhou, Taoism is mainly community rituals. So in modern West, I think doesn't understand that Taoism came about in the history of Chinese Taoism is very much a ritual history. So the rituals of Taoism is a very rich and dynamic. And I was just mesmerized in participating at so many Taoist rituals. The other thing I do is, in this chapter is I interview many Taoist monks to show the full range of different kinds of personalities who get involved with Taoism. Two kinds of sects of Taoism, one that traces back to the beginnings of religious Taoism at the end of the Han Dynasty, which features stay-at-home clerics who can marry, have children, and have other businesses while they also attend to conducting community rituals. And another line of Taoism, which are monastic monks and nuns. So I interview these people to show that there's quite a range of different kinds of people who get tracked into this ritual activity. And then chapter five is on the historical development of Buddhism in Wenzhou. Buddhism arrived in China at the end of the Han Dynasty and in Wenzhou just a little later. And there are many sects of Buddhism, but the two dominant ones are the Pure Land sect, which is more popular Buddhism, and also Chan sect of Buddhism, which over time in Wenzhou has really shares more with Pure Land than with Chan, the more austere kind of meditative Buddhism. And that aspect of Chan Buddhism has been in decline, been pretty much taken over by popular Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism, but is making a comeback now in this millennium. So in the 1980s to 90s, Buddhism was mainly folk Buddhism in Wenzhou. It's about doing prayers and offerings made to Buddhas in exchange for favors and help in their family affairs. And so the new line of development, new recent development just in the past two decades, or really in the past one decade, is a new attention to examining doctrinal matters in Buddhist scriptures as people become better educated, and to self-cultivational Buddhism, the meditational aspect of Chan, with a turn to interiority and the self. So with increasing educational levels, this latest phase of Buddhist development is perhaps not so surprising.
And I think also in terms of Taoism, probably in the last 20 years, possibly in Wenzhou, but in other cities in China too, there is this return to interrogating, right, the doctrines and, you know, trying to perceive more and study more as the rituals take place. So it might be, a larger type of trend.
Yeah, although in Wenzhou, I don't see that happening so much for Taoism because the people who are leading Taoism are not as educated, it seems. I think Taoism, the doctrines of Taoism and the self-cultivational aspects of Taoism is more in the academy across China. There's this interest, but in terms of local practice, it's not quite there yet. Yeah, but could be developing here. Yeah, because the leadership in Wenzhou is generally not college educated.
I see. Okay, so then we see this difference playing into the rituals and the ritualistic economy, right? And I think that...
Yeah, but ritual life is very rich, very abundant.
Good. And I think that is it's a very, good segue into part three entitled Religious Civil Society and Ritual Economy, where you ask and answer questions related to the resurgence of ritualism and religiosity in post-Mao China, the management of religious associations and temples, and the necessary broadening of this term that we started with, civil society, to accommodate realities in Wenzhou. And these are just a few of the themes in chapter 6 to 10. And again, as I did for part two, I would like to invite you to tell us more about each of these chapters and the extraordinary intellectual, physical, and emotional work that went into them.
Okay. So chapter 6, it provides ethnographic details on 5 or 6 temples and how they collected donations, how they organized to petition local authorities for the right to exist, how they managed daily and special ritual activities, and also describes their method of selecting leadership. And this lays the groundwork for my argument in chapter 9, which is a more theoretical chapter. It lays my argument that these initiatives represent the growth of a grassroots religious civil society. Chapter 7 is about the rebirth of lineage organization in post-Mao Wenzhou. What's interesting here is that the first activities of different lineages in the, to revive themselves in this area were not economic, even though in late imperial and republican times, lineages owned their own land and they collected rents that fed into their ritual activities. So these lineages in Wenzhou generally got started through rituals first. They collected funds for redoing their elaborate ritual genealogies, tracing kinship descent lines back 30 to 50 generations. So they rewrote their genealogies that were burned during the Cultural Revolution. They started out reviving sacrifices to the ancestors and organizing collective outings to their ancestral tombs in the mountains on the Qingming Festival, the festival of tomb sweeping. Generally in the springtime. So basically lineages are charitable organizations. They help care for widows and orphans and they organize ritual activities and they give money to poor families to support their children's education at all levels. And nowadays, girls benefit from this too. However, what's also interesting is that lineages are still not granted official recognition or legal title to exist by the state. So they have to hide under many guises, such as they can present themselves as a local history association, or as a cultural activity center, or as a museum, or as a committee for the repair of a historical monument, i.e. their old ancestor hall, which has a historical value. Then in chapter 8, this is about women's ritual agency in a culture where women remain socially conservative in Wenzhou. So here I suggest that whereas the institution of kinship and lineage are patriarchal, since descent is traced patrilineally and favors the birth of sons, women, though, can find an outlet for their creative and leadership energies through exercising religious agency. So I chronicle different forms of female religious agency, which was surprisingly abundant, I found. So I chronicle religious sisterhoods in which women get together as sisters, the sisterhood follows them throughout their lifetimes. They travel periodically to temples to worship together, often at female deities' temples. So the most important two goddesses in this area are Chen Jinggu, who's a very important goddess that emerged in Fujian. And many people in Wenzhou are, who centuries ago, migrants from Fujian. So Chen Jinggu in this area is called Chen Shisi Niangniang, so goddess Chen the 14th. And she's actually very interesting. She's a kind of what one could call quote-unquote feminist goddess. She's a martial goddess. She leads spirit armies. She has two generals underneath her. And she's a fighting woman. She's a fighting goddess. She flies around the countryside, helping people in need. And she kills demons. And her two biggest enemies are the white and green snake demon. And so in many rituals, she dispatches the snake demon. And many storytelling traditions in Wenzhou and also in Fujian is about how she fights the snake demon. And she also refuses marriage initially, which is something that Chinese goddesses do. And she also undertakes to take control of her own reproduction. So she, in order to help a community deal with drought, she knows that she's pregnant and she needs to do the rain dance, which is very exhausting and might kill the fetus. So she slices open her abdomen and pulls out the fetus and does a magical spell and to protect the fetus, and she'll get back to the fetus later. Wow. She does the ring dance, and she saves the people, but the evil snake demon eats up her fetus. Oh. So. Anyway, she has her main ancestral temple in Gutian in Fujian province, where supposedly the giant statue of her has her inside. Her corpse is kind of buried inside the statue and immortalized in that way. So I also, you know, in this chapter, basically I'm also introducing several women who took the initiative to build a temple, to usually to her, Chen Jinggu. And this involved them going out from the domestic area and domestic realm out into the public to gather donations, to petition local authorities, to get permission to build the temple and so forth. So surprisingly, quite a lot of these. So these temples start out small, but once they become big and lucrative, then the men move in. So this is an old story, I think. And so this is taking up the issue of how can we understand these women at the same time not impose too many Western liberal feminist language and agenda, because these women are socially conservative. So how to deal with their religious agency as well as leadership in terms that they could understand and accept. And so here I have a kind of engagement with, what's her name? Saba Mahmood, who recently passed away, anthropologist at UC Berkeley. Okay, so then the chapter 9, I'm addressing whether the Western Enlightenment theories of civil society are relevant or applicable to China, which has a very different history and culture. So I basically answer this question by saying that I'm only applying this term and notion of civil society to modern China, especially to post-Mao society after the rapid expansion of the state in modern China. So I suggest that civil society has become a global category because everywhere in modernity we have seen the expansion of the state. And so civil society should be able to join other terms that emerged in the West, such as class and nationalism and even governmentality has been used, has become used around the world. So there are these terms, but what I seek to do is to localize the term civil society in terms of China's own past history. So if you look at late imperial China, there was significant self-governance at the local level, where the state, I use the term hierarchical encompassment. The state, you had the centralized state, but the state was really in the capital, and its officials who passed the imperial examinations were few, and they were sent down only to the county level. And below the county level, it was basically de facto self-governance, of course, dominated by the Confucian-educated gentry. So finally, I come to the crux, and hopefully you will include this part when you edit. So the last chapter, chapter 10, is about the ritual economy. Basically, I talk about ritual economy and use it to say that the Wenzhou model is too limited. So what is important about this area is that, we have the notion, Max Weber's notion of the Protestant ethic, and that has been applied in so many areas. And then there's a push by some scholars to say that China's economic success in the post-Mao era is due to something called the Confucian ethic, which is China's version of the Protestant ethic. So I challenge that by saying that there's something much more interesting going on And we don't need any notions of the Protestant ethic or the Confucian ethic. In fact, I propose to recognize ritual economy as something very important about Wenzhou and other places in China that are like Wenzhou. And the notion of the ritual economy directly is oppositional to the notion of Protestant ethic. So here's how I define ritual economy. It's the expenditures of wealth that do not directly lead to profit accumulation. They are engaged, these activities of ritual economy are engaged in non-productive activities. Okay, so that already suggests that it's not Protestant ethic. So while Wenzhou is very successful economically, it is also giving play to non-productive activities and which do not lead to profit accumulation. Indeed, the ritual economy eats up one's profits and savings for non-utilitarian ends. So ritual economy includes investments and expenditures for rituals, for gifts and gift giving, for charitable and temple donations, for festivals, and for building religious structures and engaging in religious activities. It involves human transactions and economic exchange with the divine world of ancestors, gods, nature spirits, and ghosts. And the ritual economy diverts a segment of wealth from this world and transfers it to divine transcendent realms of the gods. And so sacrifice is an investment in the afterlife. So it's an investment in the afterlife, in divine realms, and a divestment, actually, from capitalism. So unlike the profit economy of the market, which stresses profit and accumulation of wealth, the ritual economy expresses a logic of generosity, sacrifice, and giving out of wealth, parting from one's material wealth and donating labor for higher transcendent ends.
And this also strengthens the social networks, right?
That's right. Yes, it builds up a community, a self-governance. It builds up community identity through doing rituals to icons of what Durkheim called totems of social solidarity. And I do have a quibble with Durkheim because I think he always uses the term society in the singular. And to me, that really translates to nation state. Okay, because that was also what was going on during Durkheim's time, the building up of the nation and national identity. And so it's ironic, I point out, that Durkheim was using totemism from Australian Aborigines. Australian Aborigines are an acephalous body of different societies. And the continent of Australia never saw the emergence of the state until Western Europeans arrived. So for Australian Aborigines, totems and clans should always be in the plural. Okay? So just like all these different cults, religious cults of gods and goddesses and religious temples are always in the plural. They help strengthen those horizontal communal ties.
Absolutely. And I think there is a lot to say, right, about these communities in plural and societies and the roles gender plays in these relationships and so on and so forth. But I think we've taken a lot of your time today. So I was wondering whether you could tell us more about your current projects now that this book is out.
Okay. Yeah. I'm working on a new book. It's the working title is Religious Environmentalism in the Anthropocene: Potentialities and Actualities in China and the U.S. Yeah. So I'm bringing the U.S. into it somewhat. So I'm going to deal with Protestantism in the United States. I'm also using ethnographic material that I gathered about popular religion, Taoism, and Buddhism in Wenzhou. Because Buddhism has vegetarianism, this new field of anthropology of ontology, or the ontological turn, figures somewhat in my discussion, because certainly if you look at ways of defining and being human in relation to non-human things, okay? And non-human things for me includes gods and goddesses as well as animals. So I'll be talking about human and non-human relations. And the fact that Buddhism and, contemporary Buddhists in Wenzhou, they firmly are into this idea of reincarnation. Once you die as a human, you could be reincarnated into 6 different paths. Such as animals or God. You can become a god, you can become an animal, you can become an asura, or a more kind of belligerent kind of god. You can also become a hungry ghost, forever condemned to being hungry. So these also feed into discussions for the ontological turn, and which has bearing on how we can be more environmental and deal with this new threat that's common to the human species, and that is climate change and entering into the era of the...
That is fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to reading that book too. Thank you very much for talking to us today. And I look really forward to reading your fascinating work further. And I'm just, looking forward to what is coming. One last word is thank you for today.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Bye.